This is the BBC.
This evening's prom marks the 100th anniversary later this year of Russia's October Revolution. It was the foundation of the first avowedly Marxist government in world history under the leadership of Vladimir Ilyich Ulyanov, better known as Lenin. When we go back to the Albert Hall, we'll hear Shostakovich's 12th Symphony, subtitled The Year 1917 and dedicated to the memory of Lenin. But Shostakovich's work is only a small part of the mythology that's developed around the infamous, or for some, famous revolutionary. Commentators outside the Soviet Union routinely portrayed him as a ruthless, bloodthirsty villain, hell-bent on bringing chaos and destruction to a country somewhere near you. But within the Soviet Union, he came to be painted as a sort of benevolent father of the nation, as likely to be found cradling a kitten or comforting a child, presumably in time out between organising a secret police force and overseeing forced collectivisation of farms with disastrous consequences. But who was Lenin, and how has his image been used, and how has it changed in the 100 years since he came to power? With me to discuss those questions are two people totally abreast of the latest research on Lenin, the politician and the man, mostly because it's research that they've recently carried out themselves. They're Victor Sebastian, author of Lenin the Dictator, An Intimate Portrait, and Helen Rappaport, author of Caught in the Revolution, Petrograd, 1917. Welcome to you both. Helen, the man who became Lenin was born Vladimir Ilyich Ulyanov, as we said, in 1870. Could you give us a glimpse into his early life?
Well, he was born into a fairly privileged bourgeois, well-educated family. He was very fortunate. His father was a local inspector for schools in the area where he grew up. And as such, he and his siblings enjoyed the privilege of a really good liberal education as youngsters. They were encouraged to learn languages and question everything. There was an incredible intellectual atmosphere at home, which they all shared in.
And this is home in Simbirsk.
Tell us a little bit
about the home and what the home would have
felt
like.
Well, I mean, it was a very liberally minded bourgeois family environment at Simbirsk. He certainly wasn't this impoverished worker who had suffered, you know, in order to get to the revolution. I mean, I think perhaps the Soviets underplayed his early life, Victor, don't you think?
They underplayed it. Yeah. Absolutely lied about it and kept most of it secret. He was actually a nobleman, technically. I mean, his father had, through his civil service rank, had a title, a noble title.
It was a very, very generously proportioned
house at the top of the hill.
Yeah.
They were very respected family in the upper echelons of Simbirsk society. He was totally privileged. He was not. And other things they kept about his background. The Soviets totally lied about his.
We're going to come on to a bit of the myth making in just a moment. But just let's stay back a little bit and move on from that, as you say, quite privileged, very academic household, isn't it? It's one of his most famous sayings: "Learn, learn, and learn again." And that's the feeling you have when you go to that house. This is bookish, perhaps slightly oppressive, but bookish household. When then does he get the revolutionary vibe and interest? And what drives that, Helen?
Well, he went to university in Kazan to study law and pretty much immediately became involved in the revolutionary underground. And quite early on got into trouble, as they all did at that time, because the Tsarist police were very, very much keeping all these young students under surveillance.
The main thing that drove him was an emotional thing, not through force of logic. His elder brother, by 2 years, was hanged for taking part in a plot to assassinate the then Tsar. And it was that execution of his brother and the way that his whole family were then snubbed by polite bourgeois society in which they had played such a prominent part that drove him as much as anything, as any theory of surplus value by Marx. It was an emotional thing that drove him.
And yet he didn't identify with his brother was really a terrorist. I mean, his methods were those of terrorism. And yet he writes, doesn't he, we will go a different way. He doesn't say, my brother sacrificed his life, so I'm going to sort of doing what he did. Why do you think, I mean, either of you, but what makes him decide his revolutionary theory is going to drive him as opposed to kind of bricks through windows and worse terrorist atrocities?
I think he very much detached himself from that romantic revolutionary idealism that had begun with Narodnaya Volya and the To the People movement. And his brother came in at the tail end of those hopeless idealists who thought they could just run around and produce a bomb from under their cloak and they're going to change the world. Lenin was, from day one, extremely pragmatic. So much so that he made this rather amusing remark about his poor brother Alexander, who actually was hanged on the day Lenin was sitting a maths exam, if I recall. Yeah. And he said the trouble with his brother was making this very devoted study of the life of worms. Mm. And he said, any person who studies the life of worms is not going to make a good revolutionary. He immediately...
It wouldn't be in the job advert,
no.
Would it?
Yeah, no.
Yeah.
But what does, what makes you revolutionary is interesting, and that drives you, of course, away from family, away from mainstream society, a very divided society. Why does he leave Russia?
He leaves. He's at first exiled in Siberia, and he had 3 years in, he had 2 years in jail in St. Petersburg, and then 3 years in exile in Siberia, which the conditions were not like they were in the Gulag that he helped create, but they were still pretty bad. And he wanted to set up. Main thing was when he did learn about Marxism and he did join a revolutionary group, he couldn't act in Russia. He couldn't print a newspaper, which is the main thing that he wanted to do as one of the principal weapons that he would that he would use. He needed to be out of the country in exile to be able to produce a newspaper, distribute it inside Russia. Couldn't be done inside Russia with the Tsarist secret police, the Okhrana, watching him so carefully.
And where does he go, Helen?
Well, all good revolutionaries, were going into the big revolutionary centres in Europe. They were going to Switzerland, they were going to Munich, some of them. And initially, Lenin went to Munich briefly. But really, the hub of revolutionary activity for him, where it really kicked off, was when he came to London in 1902. And the extraordinary thing about Lenin coming to London, and it's, I guess, something we as British can be proud of, welcoming this notorious revolutionary who, was wanted by the Okhrana, was that London at that time was incredibly welcoming, incredibly tolerant. And there was a whole kind of underground of exiled activists from France, from Germany, from Italy, from Russia, living in and around the East End. And they were pretty much allowed to get on with it as long as they didn't throw any bombs at anyone. So the choice of London at that time proved a very comfortable place for him politically, intellectually. And the other great reason he came, of course, was for the museum, for the British Library, for access to books he couldn't get to in Russia.
And you can still see his little blue plaque in Percy Circus.
Yeah, so we don't quite know where exactly his chair was in the original reading room, but people noticed him because he never stopped scribbling and always had piles and piles and piles of books.
And if I say, I'm a train driver, I'm a zookeeper, even perish the thought, I'm a journalist, I've got a pretty good idea of what that entails, Victor, but what is the day-to-day job of being a professional revolutionary at the time? How was the day spent?
Well, his day was spent in the morning in the British Museum reading room, and wherever he went in exile for next 12 years after that, that was always where he went to in the morning, the library. And then he'd scribble away at whichever newspaper it was, Pravda or Iskra was the first one. And wherever he was, then he'd do his journalism in the afternoon. And then the evenings, there'd be endless, you know, endless meetings of his faction, which he will. But Lenin was slightly different from other, from all, a lot of the other revolutionaries, because Lenin was serious about taking power. The others, that's what he really wanted. That's the others would have been happy sitting up there chatting away, and making revolution as they thought of it that way. And as a totally theoretical thing for him, revolution was a very practical thing. It was power that he wanted, power for himself and power to change, to change the world. So he was a, his main contribution to the revolution was I don't want to go on about in a theory, but he organized a party. He was a fantastic organizer and a tactician. And he had that sort of practical flair. He didn't want to just sit in a cafe and talk.
He used to complain that all his co-revolutionaries, people like Martov and Vera Zasulich and the other Russian emigres in London who were living in a house up the road from him, he wouldn't actually live in the same house because they were noisy and distracting. He got fed up with them because they'd sit up talking and drinking tea all night and rolling cigarettes and dropping their ash into the sugar bowl. And he was quite pernickety about that. He liked his separate space. Oh. He was a complete monomaniac. He had to work at a particular time, eat, rest.
They lived in a commune. And yeah. If it was one thing Lenin hated, it was a commune.
Communes. Absolutely hated communal living.
Absolutely.
And they all
it.
Had this terrible reputation for being so slovenly. And people talked about visiting them, other Russians getting out of Russia, going to the safe house and finding just a huge group of Russians sitting on the floor, drinking, smoking, with open cans, discarded, cans of food, discarded on the floor and piles of Russian newspapers and hardly a stick of furniture.
That's why it wasn't in House and Garden, right?
No. The word wasn't used in those days, but he was what we can now call anal, totally. He'd spend 5 minutes sharpening his pencils and they had to be at exactly the right place.
It's a wonder the revolution ever happened, really, isn't it?
But, yeah.
One thing I was very curious about when you just what you were describing there, Helen, I mean, he also, of course, had, for a lot of that time in exile, I think most of the years, his wife was with him, Krupskaya, Nadezhda Krupskaya, but also her mother, and I hadn't really realised that the mother-in-law had sort of come along for the ride. How did that work out?
Well, it's extraordinary. People don't realise that for almost the whole of those 16 years in exile, mother-in-law came too. And there was Nadia.
Dear, I think that's the unwritten stop-odd play. Yeah.
Dear devoted Nadia, who's totally sublimated her own needs, her own life, her own health to Lenin's greater need. But mother-in-law, her mother came with them everywhere. So they trailed round a succession of cheap rented flats and houses in Europe for 16 years with mother-in-law there as well. And it must have been very inhibiting, but also they couldn't have functioned without her because all this tedious, really tedious work that Lenin didn't want to do, all the card indexing and keeping note of agents and coding and decoding all the messages coming and going. Nadia and her mother sat in the kitchen doing that and then tearing everything into minute pieces.
There was serious
days before paper shredders. Mm.
There was serious conspiratorial work being done as well, and that mattered. That was all part of the organization. But it is extraordinary how Lenin was surrounded by women. Important relationships, all the important relationships, political as well as personal,
I must ask you whether you both conclude that she was indeed his mistress.
Without a doubt.
At what point does that then arise, and how does it then fit into, as you've described, a slightly hugger-mugger world in which he is the wife, he's got the mother-in-law as well. They're very close-knit,
the
mistress kept following wherever they moved, in lodging rooms they were. Inessa would find somewhere two streets away or one street away.
Revolutionary theory is suddenly looking a lot more attractive to more people, isn't it? But I mean, just tell me where it fits in. You know, flippancy aside, where does it fit in to the revolutionary mindset? His mind, as Victor said earlier, he wants something to happen. He's a practical, he's a doer of revolution.
But Inessa was a very practical woman too.
So she's
Inessa
partly,
had
part
fantastic languages. Inessa was so useful to him in the early, you know, in those years. Lenin would never allow a man to represent him at you know, important revolutionary meetings. The only other person he would allow to represent him personally was Inessa, his mistress, Inessa Amor. She was incredibly useful to him politically.
I personally think that the women in Lenin's life, the key five women, got him to the revolution without the female support, which never gets mentioned in all the hagiographies. First of all, there was mother in Russia constantly sending him money. The only occasional fleeting expressions of affection are in letters to his mother, really. I mean, the ones to Inessa were all forcibly destroyed. There were also two sisters in Russia, in and out of jail, constantly being arrested. He would harangue them endlessly. Get this article published. Check this article. Send me X number of books and so and so. They were constantly feeding him material, feeding his material needs. Then there was Nadia, poor, downtrodden Nadia, and then Inessa. But with Lenin, I think, you know, emotional and sexual needs were, for him, things that he had the same attitude to as food. He ate to stay alive. He didn't, you know, eat, you know, for the pleasure of it. And if he needed affection or sex, he went and found it. I'm sure of that.
And how did he deal with people who disagreed with him on a personal level? Because this becomes then, of course, much more important and contentious when the revolution has happened. But if we look at his personality structure and his view of other people, how does that play into how the revolution happens at all?
Well, that was the state that he created and the revolution that he created was entirely based on this part of his. He was extremely intolerant, extremely secretive, driven by tempers and furies. He wasn't the cold, one-dimensional, entirely ideological figure that, you know, of his reputation. And he used to, a lot of the language that we know of as the communist sort of form of debate and language was Lenin's abuse of anyone who would disagree with him. They were all vermin, lower than vermin. They were always, you know, it would be a dispute on some point of principle of how many angels he could stand on a pinhead. But yeah, so anyone who would disagree with him was it wasn't just an honest disagreement. Then it became crucial that he would crush them.
And he was a compulsive obsessive,
well,
I think.
This was part of his political...
An absolute monomaniac. He would talk people into submission. And there are accounts of him at party congresses where there was one in particular, was it 1905 or 1908, where it said of every session throughout the entire Congress, Lenin was the only person who attended every single session. And there are records of him getting up and speaking for 4 or 5 hours at a time. He would talk people into absolute submission. He had this incredible...
monomaniacal in the way that we now think, and that's perhaps shaped by what happens subsequently, that people with those traits in anti-democratic politics tend to be that way. But is it also a kind of paranoia that he cannot leave go? We often associate Stalin and late Stalin with paranoia driving some of his more dreadful acts, but are they in any sense sort of similar traits, or do you think they're just such different characters?
They're such different characters. I don't want to do the sort of psychobabble stuff of. I don't think he was paranoid. He was vicious in argument because it worked, and because that's the way he was going to get his party completely loyal to him. And it didn't matter whether all kinds of other factions would leave. What he was after was one party totally loyal to him. And they would do what he... They would gain power in the way he ordained they were going to take power. A lot of his viciousness was of what he would argue was practical politics, and it worked.
Don't you think it's a shame, really? When you look at the story of Lenin, those years of exile, the constant talk, long into the night, the quarrels, the congresses, it was only He fell out with every single male friend, one by one.
Absolutely.
Even Martov, his dearest friend, who he set up virtually the RSDLP with, had gone into exile with. They'd suffered and struggled together. Even Martov, in the end, of course, at the Bolshevik-Menshevik split, was rejected. It was only the women who were the constants in his life who stayed faithful to him and he to them, in the sense of not falling out.
We've talked a lot about the man, but of course the man very quickly becomes the mythology of the foundation of the Soviet Union after 1917. What is the early Lenin that is set up partly by himself but also by the machine around him to represent this? This is the first communist country in the world. How does it relate or reflect Lenin's personality, Victor?
Well, I would say he created the Soviet regime and the system in very much in his image. It would also be this secretive, this intemperate, this intolerant, intolerant way. The main thing was that they gained power in a coup. It wasn't a popular revolution. He'd harangued his other his comrades to go along with him in mounting this insurrection. And it was quite lucky that they won it, that they achieved what he wanted.
Well, they had, and you could say that it was illegitimate. They had had a number of goes, in fairness.
Well, they hadn't really. This was the first proper coup attempt. There was one 3 months before that was a sort of half attempt.
And you're not counting 1905 as being the previous.
I don't think that was a coup attempt. That was a popular revolution. In the same way that February 1917 was a popular revolution. But he took power illegitimately, and from the moment he took power, the only thing he was interested in is keeping it. So therefore, he built up this system, and he passed on this to all his successors. The important thing for the proletariat, the important thing for the working class, is that this is that our revolution survives, our party survives. And that he passed down all the way along, right through to Gorbachev
invite really Helen to comment on it between that and this sort of figure, the mythologized figure, sort of a benevolent Uncle Lenin who will be your stern guide. And you can see it in the portraiture. Mm. And like a lot of people who lived and worked in the former Soviet Union, I have a large portrait of Lenin somewhere in the attic that no one will let me kind of bring into the house properly. But what you see in it is that what we see there is a mixture of kind of sternness and benevolence, because you need that to get people to keep going with it, right? Even if they feel it's not in their interest, they're beginning to have doubts, there has to be something kind about him.
Well, of course. Well, Lenin loved his mum. He liked little children. There are pictures of him patting little children on the head. And he and Nadia in London, there are accounts of them being very fond of the children of some of the other revolutionaries they met. And the other thing is, he adored cats. Yeah. They both did. Yeah. So that for me, what's so interesting about those three leaders, Lenin, Stalin, Trotsky, is there's Trotsky, the firebrand, the charismatic orator, the poster boy up there on the podium. There's Stalin, this Machiavellian, dark, mysterious backroom boy whose legacy really is that, he had sex with underage girls and robbed banks. That is, Stalin is sexy. Lenin isn't sexy. Lenin is kind of the good guy of the revolution. And I've heard Russians say this to me when they've read my books. They said, gosh, I didn't realise Lenin was so ruthless. And that's the work of the hagiographer.
But I think that's also the de-Stalinisation, isn't it? And for those of us who knew Eastern Europe in the 1970s, 80s, 90s, once you've put Stalin in the bad box, you need something to retreat to. So you go to Lenin.
That's exactly what happened in the 50s. But it was Stalin who created this figure of Lenin being this grand. He was instantly the grandfather, even though they had no children. He was Dedushka Lenin, this benign figure, and everything. All the biographies had to hide so much of the other stuff. But it was crucial.
Is how you dealt with that.
It justified a lot of the cruelty that they accepted had happened. To have this figure there, okay, The end justified the means. They created this. It needed, but deep down, this was a loving man. This was a loving man who cared for humanity.
We want a little bit of daylight letting on the biographer's craft here, as we know that you toil away for years on these books. And how difficult is that? There's that cult of Lenin, that Soviet cult of Lenin, the hagiography, the mythology, and all the accretions make it to research the real man. And when you find something, you think, well, I'm pretty sure about this, but I'm not, you know, how far do you kind of unravel the ball of wool to find out whether this
well,
is something
really difficult? When I did Lenin in Exile, and my book only takes him till he gets off the train at the Finland station, I got so frustrated by the historiographers completely sanitising the true Lenin, completely obliterating any real reference to his emotional life, his private life, his life with his wife, you know, all those aspects of the personality that fascinated me, at least. And in the end, the only accounts of Lenin, I went to foreign accounts, people who knew him in exile, to Finns and Poles and people in France, people in London who met him. And I actually virtually didn't touch anything published in the post-Lenin era. There are one or two things just before his death published in Russia that were okay, but practically everything, you could just forget it, because you weren't going to get an honest account.
No, but after that, his politically, he was supposed to be the kindly one. There was nothing about him creating the Cheka, the KGB. There was nothing about the millions of people that were murdered in the rebellions against him in the civil war, the kulaks, the campaigns against the kulaks. All of that, it all happened. It was all Stalin was to blame. Lenin was actually this benign figure who created this wonderful state that they had, and everything was then blamed, easily
blamed on
Stalin.
And it's interesting how long that story lasted. I want to come up to date a bit and look at the reception of Lenin, but I think it's a very good time to go to the audience, and I have a feeling this might come up anyway, as we live in such sort of interesting, turbulent times. Yes, a gentleman down here.
Thanks. I mean, you've already indicated that Lenin was very, very similar to Stalin. Would Stalin have existed with his even greater purges and even greater gulags had not Lenin been the precursor? Obviously, there are one or two things Lenin did which Stalin immediately ended. He ended the new economic policy. He insisted on forced collectivization. But basically, although there were different characters, Stalin comes out of Lenin.
Lenin created Stalin.
Yeah.
He chose him to be originally the bandit who'd do rob the banks. That Stalin would have been nowhere without Lenin. He was totally, and it was Lenin who created all the institutions which Stalin then used in a much more ruthless and bloody way.
One thing I wondered, I mean, people obviously going over to the concert tonight and looking at the Shostakovich, the number 12, the year 1917, which people are going to be listening to in a moment, or in a moment again. What is the attitude of Shostakovich to Lenin? Either of you?
Well, there is a story that Shostakovich was a very Soviet, entirely Soviet figure. He tells a story in one set of memoirs that he went to see, as an 11-year-old, went to see Lenin when he arrived at the Finland station from the sealed train. And other memoirs, he said, no, that wasn't that. I meant that figuratively. That Shostakovich respected Lenin, but actually he sort of hated communism. He loved communism. He, at some point, depending on who he was talking to, he took all the honours that the Soviets would give him, yet he would use irony in his music to mock it.
He liked you a bit of a dance as a biographer,
I
think, Shostakovich. He
was exactly like so many people lived in the Soviet years. Yeah. It depended who he spoke to, what his attitude was, and truth was a malleable thing. Sometimes he would use it truth literally, other times, as he said, he would use it figuratively.
Do you feel you can hear that in the work, or do you think you see the work as just the monumentalism of 1917?
Some people who are far more, musicologists say they can point to ironic bits within some of the more monumental works to show that what his true feelings are. I'm not sure that on an amateur's listening that you could pick that up. But his attitude was pretty much like a lot of the Soviets who endured for 50 years. They could get what they could out of it. And yet, to their friends, they would say they hated it.
Well, as I say, it would be very interesting to hear Petrenko's sort of interpretation there of Shostakovich later. Yes, I've got another question in the middle. Thank you.
Yeah, there's just been a jolly good exhibition at the British Library, Revolution 1917, which included extracts from films made after the revolution and how incredibly fictional most of them were. I also know that more or less fictional accounts were made of Lenin's mother, and she was made a great sort of hero. Wondered if you'd like to comment on that.
Well, the classic fictionalization has got to be Eisenstein's October, with this ridiculous mythical storming of the Winter Palace. And I, in fact, have written about that in my book, and in fact, there was no storming. They pretty much walked in, because the palace was defended by a few young cadets, I think some members of the Bicycle Brigade.
And the Women's
Battalion. And the Women's Deaf Battalion, who are my pet subjects, as it were. But, I mean, it's a nonsense, this mythical the image of them clambering over the gates and storming in. And even John Reed and Louise Bryant and their friends, Rhys Williams and Bessie Beattie,
they walked in.
They admitted it. They said so in their memoirs. But somehow the myth...
I would like to counter-challenge you a bit on that, Helen, see what Victor thinks about this. I think the reason that it is obviously a myth, but it's because it's semi-religious, and it's a bit like pointing out bits of, clearly bits of metaphor that have been grafted onto religion, saying, look at that, that's ridiculous. I mean, the extent to which this comes out of an anti-religious theory coming out of a society that was deeply religious, don't you think you end up, strangely, with a bit of both, and that accounts for a lot of what you describe?
Well, it's a hugely important piece of iconography of the revolution.
Well, there's nothing more important than iconography of the revolution. There's a mausoleum that's still there.
Yeah.
I mean, that if you want something religious about, this great internationalist leader, Marxist leader, atheist... there is bone. There he still is after all this time, and that was a deliberate thing again to try and legitimise him in what was still a religious country. There is. It was like the bones of the saints.
Of sin,
And any
it was
attempt
very,
to take
very
it
much,
away
and it was
always
it's
ended
totally,
in disaster.
It was totally a religious cult. Yeah.
Good. Anyone else just sparked any thoughts? Yes, sir. Hi.
How has the image and attitudes towards Lenin changed since Putin came to power?
Well, Putin, it's quite difficult for Putin because he hated communism. Actually didn't really like Lenin. Putin's grandfather, just as a little... totally unimportant fact, was Lenin's cook, in fact. So there is a connection for a couple of years. Yes, he was. But it wasn't. It's not just for family feeling that he has this. There is a problem for Lenin, particularly now. In this, more is being done here to sell it to mark the 100th anniversary than is being done in Russia. And there's an obvious reason, which is it doesn't do a man like Putin much good to say, actually, you can get rid of your ruthless autocratic leaders in a revolution if you feel like it and if you're so organised.
The impression
But he is such an important figure in Russian history that you can't ignore him, which is why they haven't got rid of Lenin's mausoleum. Sorry.
Well, the impression I've got from Russians is they now look upon the revolution as a crime. They're hardly marking it. I'm curious to see what they're going to do in October, because so far in Russia they've hardly had anything to say about the revolution. The big one is going to be next year. Next year's 100th anniversary of the murder of the Romanovs, I suspect, I'm going to stick my neck out, is going to be huge in Russia. It's going to be a massive ceremony of remorse and need for forgiveness. It's also going to really be a high point
I'll come back here and we'll eat my hat if Vladimir Putin says much about
it. Putin's rumoured to be going.
An autocratic leader is even worse than getting rid of one in a revolution.
But I think Helen does raise something very interesting, which is
from Russia is that it's going to be huge.
I think there will be huge interest in the public, and I think official Russia will not be happy about it. But I think you do raise a very interesting point, which is you can get through one awkward anniversary of a revolution by just playing it calm, but there are many things that pop up again.
I agree with you. I think there will be, but amongst people there will be, that it all went wrong. People are saying that it all went wrong in Russian history with the revolution.
Huge glorification of the Romanovs.
Well, they've sanctified him for a start.
Nicholas
II, the worst Tsar there ever was.
I think that's an overstatement.
Putin is still a man of the Russian deep state.
There've been worse Tsars.
I don't think the Tsar.
Oh my gosh, they're going to continue this in the bar. Yeah. Anyone who's got a strong view on the Romanovs, they'll be over there a bit later. Can I just see if there's anyone else? Yes, there's a gentleman over there.
Yeah, I get a little bit tired of people debunking communism, because what would be nice, because I heard, I mean, it's not that I'm a communist, it just comes at you from the BBC all the time, I feel. But what would have been nice, because I heard, or I read, sorry, somewhere, that it was normal in a Russian winter to lose 1 million people. So, I mean, I don't know if that's true, but that's what I read. And my sense of Russian history is that actually the Soviet Revolution was actually business as usual. You know, you just got another form of dictatorship.
Yeah.
And nobody seems to want to say that. Everybody seems to want to say, actually, it's the revolution. But what would be nice would be a contrast of information, what the Tsar was like. And you said the secret police were so absolutely, you know, in control of everything under Tsarist Russia, and the KGB just replaced them.
But what they had promised was the liberation of mankind, equality, to create a new kind of human where everything would be wonderful. They wanted to create equality of opportunity, all the good things about about communism, and they didn't. They failed lamentably in creating this new world that Lenin had and the other Bolsheviks had wanted.
But that's an interesting part of the question to me, which is how different does revolution feel like the vast upheaval that we've described it as being outside maybe the major centres where it's going on, or how different does it feel from what's gone on before? Increasingly weak Tsar, great unfairnesses in the society, incarceration of parts of the population.
Well, I, from my experience of the research I did, there was a marked contrast between February and October, two very different revolutions. And the spirit of France, 1789, liberté, égalité, fraternité. Russians were going around the streets singing the Marseillaise, making those statements, wearing red rosettes. It was all a bit Les Mis at times. And there was this incredible sense of popular revolt, a passion for change, the fact that the whole corrupt, decadent, worn-out Tsarist order had to go. And that huge energy and passion and spirit of February, I think, gets forgotten about with this emphasis always on the political takeover, on Lenin and the Bolsheviks and the mind-numbing politics of the Soviet period that followed, the spirit of the Russian people, the real revolution, very quickly was lost. It's like Victor said, there was all this great hope for a socialist utopia.
But I'm going to be devil's advocate, Victor, and suggest that when revolutionary sort of theory goes a bit wrong, it's always the previous revolution which was all right. And the one that actually brought you to power is the one that then throws up the problems. And do you share Helen's view that you can distinguish between these two dates and that one is more...
I think just in the obvious way, one was a spontaneous revolution to get rid of the ancien regime, and one was a political coup, a takeover. Yeah. So, yes. And how people lived were... and it is true that in Russia it had this ghastly history. It was the same, is holding it up to the same standards as the three centuries of Tsarist autocracy. And the Bolsheviks themselves would refuse to have themselves held up by that standard.
Well, before there's an audience rebellion, as they all head over for the concert, I just wondered, for either of you, very short insight. Is there anything that Lenin said or did that we might be surprised about? I'm not going to... It's unfair to pick on one of you first.
I can't think off the top of my head.
Oh, I think... Well, as I was researching, a huge amount. I mean, he wrote incredibly beautifully about... He wrote interminably awful texts, but he wrote beautifully about nature and climbing mountains and look and field. He could identify scores of species of plants, which I didn't know.
Well, I'm amazed that he walked most of Switzerland, which was the big, you know, stress buster in his life. He loved the mountains, and that was the only thing that stopped him from going into complete meltdown.
I love the idea of Lenin and the stress buster. who knows what might have happened had he not...
He loved Hampstead Heath. That was the stress buster.
Oh, and he liked the English music hall. He found that very enjoyable when he was here.
No, that I didn't know. Well, I'm sure we'll hear more about Lenin and the October Revolution as the centenary approaches. But it's time for us to return to the Royal Albert Hall now for the rest of tonight's Proms programme. Join me, please, in thanking Helen Rappaport and Victor Sebastian and the audience here at the Bate Hall.